This is day three of this December 2017 four-day session, and going to continue reading from Master Sheng Yan, and the name of the book is Attaining the Way, a Guide to the Practice of Chan Buddhism. And we're going to continue hopping about in this book. Again, these are basically compilations of talks that Sheng Yan gave in various sessions in the early 1990s, sort of compiled and assembled and published. This section I'm beginning with here is called An Island of Time and Space. This is advice, I think, that he gives at the very beginning of Sesshin, but it's good to hear it, even though we're right in the middle here, right in the thick. He says, when practicing on retreat, isolate yourself. First, drop everything from the past and everything related to the future. Create an island of time that separates you from before and after these days of Sesshin. Refrain from reading, writing, talking, and making phone calls. That's pretty obvious. So far as the outside world is concerned, you did not exist before and you will not exist afterward. You are living on a virgin island with no knowledge of anything outside. Unless you think like this, you will be dragging along a huge tail, carrying a lot of baggage, and it will be very painful. You will have come not to meditate, but to indulge in false thinking. If any outside thoughts occur to you, tell yourself, I was born on this virgin island. These outside thoughts have nothing to do with me. Second, isolate yourself from others. Within this island of time, create an island of space which only you inhabit. There is only one person on your cushion, you. Give your body to the cushion and your mind to the method. If people walk by you or sit beside you, this has nothing to do with you. If someone behaves strangely, if someone runs in and does cartwheels, or if your back itches, you will respond the same way. This has nothing to do with me. There is a saying, fundamentally there is nothing in the world to be concerned about, but people make trouble for themselves. If the outside world does not influence your mind, nothing can disturb you. People make trouble for themselves. This is one of the lessons of Sesshin. We begin to get an idea of how much of our dissatisfaction, unhappiness, anxiety, anger, it's all self-generated. It's the beauty of Sesshin that we are on a virgin island. We do have this ability to just leave the past behind. There's nothing we need to plan out. Why not? Why not let it all go? Can even let the previous days of Sesshin and the days to come go. Get it down to just this one breath. He says, third, isolate yourself from your previous thought and from your succeeding thought, good or bad. Do not be concerned with them. Just take the present thought and tie it to the meditation method. That's what's most important. The past is gone, the present is dying, and the future is not yet. Regret, satisfaction, worries, expectations, these are all delusions. Do not waste a second on them. Isolate yourself from your previous thought. Thought comes into the mind, especially if it's a disturbing one, or actually anything that has anything to do with us. It's hard to completely drop it. So let it go. We gradually become better at doing this if we're diligent about doing it. And why worry about your succeeding thought? Take care of that when it arises. This next section is to become ripe and expert. When you learn a method of Chan meditation, you should use that method to go from being raw and naive to being ripe and expert. This cultivation of sitting meditation we call practice. If you have questions, ask a knowledgeable teacher. If the teacher cannot help, you must rely on yourself to make the proper adjustments to your practice or to your mental state. Practice does not mean relying on your teacher to tell you everything. When you begin, your practice will not be very pure or thorough. After practicing for some time, relying on the wisdom of others before you, you will be able to add to and guide your own practice. You will then become completely pure, content, and thoroughly proficient. He doesn't actually say when this will happen. It's where we're pointed, put it that way. And the next section is entitled Relaxing. In the course of the retreat, I may teach several meditation methods, but with just two goals in mind. The first is to help you relax your body and mind. The second is to help you pacify and stabilize your body and mind. In reality, these two goals are aspects of the same thing. If you can relax, you will be stable and at peace. And if you are stable and at peace, you will relax. But the place to start is relaxing. You could say that peace and stability are the result of relaxing. If you can relax your body and mind, your vexations are sure to be reduced, your pressures and burdens will be lightened, and your capacity for wisdom will be enhanced. Can't take anything in when we're tense. Certainly can't take as much in. Your capacity for wisdom will be enhanced. With mind and body relaxed, your attention will be concentrated, your body functions will be balanced, and your mind will be calm and peaceful. People sometimes recite the Buddha's name and transfer the merit to others in order to create good karma for sentient beings. This is the Pure Land practice. In China, Zen and the Pure Land practice often are found in the same temple, in the same monastery. The two really sort of are cohabit. It seems that in Japan they're a little more separate. And in the Pure Land, the practice is to recite the name of Amitabha Buddha. I take refuge in the Buddha Amitabha, or Namu Amida Butsu. And it's believed that by doing so, one gains merit, and after dying will go to Amitabha's heaven, where practice is easy, it seems, and they are come to awakening. But the practice itself is actually quite powerful, and there are many people in the Pure Land School who have understanding, come to awakening. In some of the Chinese monasteries, I've read of the practice of asking, who is it who says the name of Buddha, takes refuge in the Buddha. And then, of course, the transferring merit to others in order to create good karma for sentient beings. The whole question of transfer of merit is taken very seriously in the Asian countries. Hasn't caught on as much here in the West. Nevertheless, the motivation for our practice is to help other people. Through our efforts, others will benefit. And he says, while this is useful, its effect is indirect. However, if we can relax our bodies and our minds, and as a result, change our words, actions, and disposition, this will be more directly useful to ourselves and others. Words, actions, and disposition. Our tension and anxiety, our grasping, makes us less open, makes us less compassionate. When we're stressed out, others pay the price. Of course, we do too. We're all in it together. It says, strenuously seeking good things and avoiding bad things will create a lot of tension. So avoiding both of these extremes can go a long way toward relaxing our bodies and minds in daily life. There is a karmic reason for every occurrence in our life. You hear people say there are no accidents. It's a profound truth there. Everything is the way it is. We only have this one hand to play. The time we spend wishing that things were different is wasted. It actually gets in the way of doing anything to make things better. He says, therefore, as you encounter each one, each occurrence, deal with it calmly and serenely. Thus it is easier to be relaxed. This is an example of practice and daily living exemplifying Chan. Such a big step forward when we can just say yes to the conditions of our life. We don't have to like them. We don't have to be glad that our legs ache or glad that we've failed at some task or have to endure something that's unpleasant. But we can get into it. We can see what's there. This next section is called Illumination Without Effort. To achieve a concentrated state of mind when you sit, you must pass through three levels. The first is called picking it up, which means to return to the method over and over. In other words, if gaps or interruptions occur, you just keep returning to the method. You know, we hear this again and again and again, just to come back, get distracted, pulled off of the practice, just bring it back. But it really helps to set your mind to it, to renew your effort with each breath, to be determined, I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to keep coming back. It's a refuge, the practice, the return. So it's quite simple. If gaps or interruptions occur, you just keep returning to the method. The second level is contemplation, which occurs when there are no gaps in your method and it goes smoothly and continuously. If your contemplation continues on a smooth course without interruptions, you may reach the third level, illumination. It is the clear awareness that you are practicing the method. Of the three, illumination is the most important. When you are working smoothly on all three levels, you are truly using the method correctly. During such times, speaking of scattered mind is irrelevant, since there will be no scattering. Working on all three levels will also help you to overcome drowsiness, although sometimes the best thing to do is rest. It's one of those things that we have to work out for ourselves. When to rest, when to sit up late. To be open to doing what we don't feel like doing. Sometimes there's a reluctance to rest just because we're so driven, trying to measure up to some standard that we've imposed on ourselves. And of course, probably more commonly, we're driven to lay down in bed and just take a break. Have to look at it closely and pay attention to results. See what happens. Sit up too late and see what happens. Go to bed too early and see what happens. Find our way. He says, as of now, most of you should be concerned with the first level, namely, taking up the method. Don't be swayed by tempting thoughts. Of course, tempting thoughts can be pleasant thoughts, things that we enjoy. Those are tempting. Some very unpleasant thoughts that are also tempting, that we get hooked by. The obvious category is thoughts about ourself, thoughts about our practice. These are tempting because somehow they seem like something that we shouldn't ignore. But we can. Don't need those thoughts. Just continuously bring yourself back to the method. Whatever method you use, counting the breath, the koan, shikantaza, point your attention inward. The light of awareness needs to reflect back to illuminate the mind. Therefore, while meditating, you should know whether you are dull, scattered, or really on the method. This itself is cultivation, to know where your mind is. It's reflecting back, looking within. This really changes the nature of our practice. What we're doing isn't something outside ourselves. We're working with the mind. How could we be outside the mind? In breath counting, for example, you will naturally be aware that you are counting the breaths. It is not a direct awareness, but peripheral, indirect, unintentional. This awareness is illumination. It should be present no matter which method you use. I should make clear that illumination is not concentration. Concentration demands energy, but illumination is effortless. It rises of its own accord as a natural part of the method. It is like a mother who is busy while her child plays nearby. Although not watching the child directly, she is always aware of the child. After you have spent considerable time practicing a method, illumination will be so strong that you will no longer be aware of external stimuli. You will be close to that level beyond awareness of space and time, where thoughts are minimal and the body ceases to be a burden. This is effective practice indeed. There's Roshi often points this out, that there are two aspects to practice, sort of two wings of the bird. One is concentration, which we're all familiar with. The other is awareness. Can't really say that one is more important than the other, but definitely don't want to neglect awareness. It's awareness that allows us to know that we've strayed. Sometimes people, when their concentration becomes very strong, sometimes at the end of the sesshin, can go way off track, get into just the most amazing states of mind, not even being aware of how crazy things have gotten. Can see some pretty amazing makyo sometimes. So what's missing is just that awareness. To know that we're sitting. Know where the mind is at. Doesn't mean judging, just this awareness. Like this metaphor that he uses, this analogy, mother watching a child, although not watching it directly, just aware of it. The awareness is clear, but it's not nervous or tense. Not flogging ourselves to be aware. Next section is called centering. When we engage in practice, whether standing or sitting, mindfulness requires that we be properly centered. And this starts with having your center of gravity below the waist. When sitting in meditation, if you feel your mind and vital energy, that is your chi, dissipating, make a conscious effort to place your center between your buttocks and the cushion. That is, feel your bottom on the cushion. If you feel pressure in your head or blockage in your chest, you should put the feeling of the center on the soles of your feet. Especially if you're sitting cross-legged, this can bring the mind down. The position of the hands when sitting should be just below the navel. The curved left palm should rest on the curved right palm, the thumbs touching to form an oval. This will enable the mind to concentrate and settle down. It will also cause the sense of the body's center to naturally follow the hands and settle below the waist. When standing in the Chan Hall or before the Buddhist shrine, listening to a lecture or speaking with your teacher, the same principle applies. Locate your center below your waist or on the soles of your feet. And finally, be sure to relax the muscles at the point where you've placed the feeling of the center. This is a good point. It's a tendency, you put the mind down in the tanden, just below the navel, to want to somehow squeeze. There is a pleasant tension down there when your attention is in the tanden, in the area below the navel, but you want to be relaxed. You want to be easy and flowing. This next section is called All Activities Are Chan. All Activities Are Zen. Speech and silence, motion and stillness, walking, standing, sitting, and lying down, these are all practice. In the Chan Hall, sitting, standing, walking, stretching, these are all forms of practice. Outside the hall, eating and drinking, sleeping and arising, working after meals, all places, all moments, these are also practice. When doing tasks that do not require thought, you can recite the Buddha's name or count breaths. Of course, with us, it's the breath, the koan, when doing work that requires your attention, make sure that your mind and hands work together. It's a good way of putting it. Your mind and your hands work together. Your mind should be where your hands and body are. Washing dishes, leave them spotless. Cutting vegetables, be the knife that cuts perfectly. Splitting firewood, heating water, sweeping the floor, put your whole mind and strength into the task cleanly and skillfully. This is practicing Chan. Concentrate on your food when eating. Chew deliberately and do not let your mind wander. Going to bed, put aside the four elements of the body, the five aggregates of form, sensation, conception, volition, and consciousness, the four elements and the five skandhas. Basically, put it all aside. Forget past, present, and future. Just have a good sleep. That, too, is Chan. It's so strengthening to our practice when we really do go about our tasks, our daily life, with this attention. The two feed each other. Don't neglect it. Next section, plowing and weeding. Coming to retreat to accomplish something may be a correct attitude, but for now, you must forget all about goals. When working on the farm, you focus on plowing and weeding, not on the harvest. Storms, floods, droughts, and earthquakes are all beyond your control. If causes and conditions and past merit are good, there will be a rich harvest. If not, there may be a meager one or none at all. The farmer's only choice is to put his whole heart and strength into his work. He cannot ensure any results. Yet, the very experience of arduously tilling and planting is itself a precious thing. Therefore, we make practice itself a goal we can rely on. Whatever you are doing, eating, meditating, cooking, cutting vegetables, that is both the practice and the goal. Just single-mindedly apply yourself to the task with an even, down-to-earth, balanced mind. With your mind thus free from peripheral issues, you will truly practice Chan. Good results appear when you don't covet gain and just pay attention to the practice. With this attitude, you will surely harvest a bountiful crop someday. T.S. Eliot said, "Ours is only the trying. The rest is not our business." This is such a pernicious thought, the thought of results. How am I doing? Interrupts the practice again and again and again. It can become this habitual thought that somehow has a free pass into our mind. You need to recognize it for what it is. It's a delusion. It's a distraction. It's not what we're here to do, to worry about results. It takes humility to put that aside. Whether I accomplish something or I don't, just going to give myself as fully as I can in every moment to my practice. I'm not responsible for anything else. It's the only thing under my control, where I put my attention. This section is called Cat and Mouse. If you have climbed a mountain, you know that sometimes it goes smoothly and other times it's difficult. Meditation is like that. Sometimes things go well, but other times you have negative physical and mental reactions. It is normal to sit well for a while and later not do so well. Who hasn't had that happen? Our physical and mental strength are assets that we expend. A car speeds smoothly along, but still it uses up gas. Similarly, you may sit well, using up energy, and later feel tired. So if you sit well for the time it takes to burn a stick of incense, that is, for a round of sitting, don't expect that your practice will always go well. We're really, to some extent, we're at the mercy of conditions, and they're always changing. Certainly learn this firsthand in Sesshin. In the Sesshin itself, for some reason, we tend to move together like a school of fish. Not absolutely ironclad. People can be deeply concentrated while others are hitting their worst patch. But the Sesshin tends to stick together. It means that the efforts we make to bring ourselves back are really, truly helping other people. And we're truly being helped by others. For old hands, experienced cultivators, it's different. Without exerting to the utmost, their meditation is like a fine stream that flows on forever. Experienced travelers know how to conserve their energy and nurture it, keeping themselves sharp. A good martial artist will not overuse his moves or squander his strength needlessly. And old hands are like this. They meditate in a very normal frame of mind, keeping solid and steady, nurturing their strength until it comes forth. They certainly do not let their minds bounce up and down. More accurately, whether people are old hands does not depend on how long they have been practicing. Being an old hand means carefully studying the methods of practice and using them without wasting physical or mental energy. It means sitting continuously without losing the method. Chan Master Da Wei called this ability the place of saving power. People who know how to meditate tie their minds to the practice. People without this skill struggle with illusory thoughts. Tying your mind to your practice means that you are aware that you are meditating somewhat between consciously and unconsciously. Having discursive thoughts means that you have a stranglehold on the practice. You're tense, strained, and using a great deal of energy, fearing from one moment to the next that illusory thoughts will intrude. And of course they will. If you proceed this way, you will soon collapse from exhaustion. Tying your mind to your practice means that your mind is light and calm, and your body is relaxed. I thought of the analogy of using a handsaw back when the center was being resurrected from the fire in 1969. We had a guy come to help us. His name was Andy Schlageter, and he was a master carpenter and taught a lot of us carpentry. And one of the things I really remember vividly is him explaining how to use a handsaw. He was old school, and he didn't ever use, well, maybe, I never saw him use a circular saw, you know, the power saw. He just had his handsaw, and he didn't have a tape measure, he had a folding rule. But boy, he knew how to use them. And when we young guys would pick up a saw and try to cut a 2x4, there was a lot of tension. You know, you're trying to use as much muscle as you can, cut through it cleanly, quickly. But he taught us to just loosely, holding the arm loose, you just throw the saw just back and forth. Let the teeth do the work. You really don't have to press down hard. And it was amazing how quickly he could cut through wood with that saw. It really was probably, in a way, faster than somebody using a skill saw. Tying your mind to your practice means your mind is light and calm, your body is relaxed. Once a wise cat catches a mouse, the mouse will not escape. The cat is very casual, as if playing with the little beast. The cat may even let it escape a little and then cut its path off and recapture it. It doesn't tire itself in frantic pursuit of the prey. Only kittens act nervously, throwing themselves into hot pursuit. Imitate a canny old cat, not a kitten trying to catch a large rat. Feel a little sorry for the mouse there, but we're looking at this from the cat's point of view. When meditating, don't waste your energy and don't go to desperate lengths. This is contrary to the way a lot of people approach their practice. Don't waste your energy. Yes, don't go to desperate lengths. Doesn't mean that we're not completely determined. Doesn't mean that we're not willing to do what it takes. It's just not overdoing it, not getting the tension involved. You should feel as if you were waiting at ease for a tired enemy, unhurried and relaxed. Deal with obstacles skillfully rather than blundering forward. I've already told you to isolate yourself from outside concerns, to relax and to be natural. This is the same principle. We practice Chan to unfurl our wisdom. Wisdom means awakening or bodhi. It only appears when afflictions drop away. Affliction and bodhi are opposites, but they share the same essence. People whose minds are muddy with afflictions, whose emotions are unstable, are blind to bodhi. Some people hope to get enlightened, but have not thought about changing their disposition. They complacently assume that all they need is a gift from the teacher, a method for getting enlightened. This kind of person thinks, all I need is to get enlightened, then I will have wisdom and no longer have afflictions. This reverses cause and effect. First, we should change our disposition and reduce our defiled energy. Only then can we attain wisdom and reach enlightenment. So much of the change from practice comes before there's any kind of an awakening experience. People really do mature over time. Practice itself does the work. Now he has an interesting analogy here. In the past, people who had no plumbing used cesspools. During the summer, a thick layer of excrement would form at the top, and this would, in effect, contain the stench. Not sure exactly how that would work. Maybe because it was dry, it wasn't quite so smelly. Sort of shit cap. In the winter, the cesspool would freeze over and still not stink. The foul smell would be released only in the spring when the ice was broken or the layer of excrement was penetrated. A retreat is like stirring up a cesspool in the springtime. If you keep it sealed, the mess is still contained inside and the noxious vapors get even worse. Thus, you need to churn it up again and again, expose it to the cleansing air of practice. So it is a good thing to discover one's defects and illusory thoughts during retreat. The more you know your own deficiencies, the sounder your character can become. To transform your disposition from a turbid to a clear and pure state, you must take your afflictions and transform them into compassion and wisdom. The milder your afflictions become, the sounder and healthier your mind will be, and this will benefit others. Otherwise, a sesshin won't do much good. To be really useful to yourself and to others, you must take with you the mind of compassion and the mind of wisdom. To reduce afflictions, begin by reducing expectation, seeking, and eagerness for success and gain. In other words, don't be greedy. We give ourselves to our practice. We don't try to take from our practice. This is how it works. Well, there's more here, but this is a good place to stop, and our time is up. We'll now recite the four vows.
Great way of Buddha, I bow to it.